I really need to confess something to all of you. I almost yielded to temptation. I mean, I came very, very close. But in the end, I did not title this sermon, The Rise of Skywalker. A fantastic journey. But it did make me think of another journey that took place this time of year. And it did begin with an extraordinary event in space. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself, so let me backtrack a bit. The story goes back a little more than 2,000 years ago. In fact, it goes back exactly 2,023 years. It's a story about an exotic band of people and a special journey they would make that would take them across miles of desert sand. Tatooine? No, I'm sorry. And through strange countries. But before their journey could begin, they had to scan the outermost limits and recesses of space. Space, that final frontier. So they searched the night skies every evening for what might have seemed like ages. And it may well, very well have been that their predecessors had, in fact, scanned those same skies for almost that long. They were looking for something special, a sign in the skies from God, a signal from him that he was doing something significant in his world, that he was starting to intervene on earth once again. Then someone saw something the likes of which they had never seen before. They had found what they were looking for. And so excitedly, they shared their discovery with their associates. And anxiously, and in fact rapidly, they packed their bags for a long journey. The sign, a very different light in the skies, was moving. It was as if it was urging them on, leading them to where God himself had stepped into history. So they eagerly started their journey in 2023 years ago on this very night. They were less than 48 hours from their destination. The intersection in history where God had opened a door in time and space, and he himself had stepped in through that door as one titled Emmanuel, exactly as the ancient Jewish prophet had predicted. In fact, some very ancient traditions, backed by good historical and geographical data, acknowledge that Monday, the 6th of January, is the day of the historical, or commemorates the day of the historical arrival of these wise counselors from the royal courts of the Near East who followed the star. Now, this star exhibited strange behavior. After moving west to Jerusalem, it was as if it had made a left turn of sorts and went south to Bethlehem. Then it hovered over the place where the Messiah was born. Strange star. Theologians, scientists, computer specialists, and plain old inquisitive people have tried to explain the mystery of what is called the Star of Bethlehem. Yet there is no agreement on just what this star actually was. Some say a comet, some say a meteor, some say a supernova, some say a convergence of three planets, Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars. Some theories have more validity than others, but it is still a mystery. How can a star change direction and hover over a house? Mysterious still. But the Magi realized that, as they put it, the King of the Jews is born. His star, they say, has appeared. Now, that raises an important question. How could they have known about the Jewish king when they were residing in Persia? Well, I suggest that some people had obviously heard and had paid attention to people like Daniel, Esther and Mordecai, to Zerubbabel, Ezra and Nehemiah. They may have heard of the faithfulness and the God of Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael, in case you've forgotten who they are, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay. Keeping track. And they may still have been aware of the ancient prophecies of that strange prophet, Ezekiel. In other words, the lives and words of these people of God sunk in. And according to a number of scholars, some or all of the Magi may have been Jews. And perhaps they were students of the school of Daniel. So these wise people remembered, and they came. But it reminds us to check ourselves. Is that the kind of impact we leave behind on people? That these people left behind so that these wise people called the Magi were ready to move as they did move. Well, that's enough meddling. Let's go back to our story. What was their intent? Their intent was to worship the newborn king. You see, they knew the significance of the events they were participating in. They knew the importance of the child they were searching for. Do we? In the hubbub of the holidays, have we missed the significance of the events or downplayed the celebration of the holiday itself? Do we forget the importance of the child whose birth is celebrated? We can understand the significance of the events they participated in, and we can appreciate the importance of the child. If we read and understand, let me suggest, among other things, the Haftarah for the Shabbat, as they may very well have done themselves. After all, it was the Haftarah for the Shabbat just before they arrived in Bethlehem. The Haftarah for Vayigash, the name of our parsha for tonight, is Ezekiel chapter 37, 15 to 28. Parts of it was, in fact, read to you. It's a passage that is often misunderstood and frequently misused. Out of this passage misunderstood comes the whole strange theory of the house of Ephraim, or the interesting anecdotes about the 10 lost tribes. But let's focus on the text. The text talks about Ephraim, and when it talks about Ephraim, it's talking about the northern kingdom. You know, the kingdom of Israel after the kingdoms had divided. And Ephraim, in this text, if you listen to the text carefully, is basically equal to Joseph, and certainly points us to thinking about Joseph, who was that specially blessed child of Jacob. Therefore, the sages connected this Haftarah with our parsha for this week, because Ezekiel predicts the reunification of the northern kingdom of Israel with the southern kingdom of Judah. Remember the picture? Two sticks. In one hand, the two sticks become one. It predicts the reunification of the two kingdoms. Similarly, the parsha reports on the reunification of Joseph with his brothers. But, like the Haftarah, so this parsha is a story which has many layers. What happens here, if you listened, in the very first words of the parsha, I read and then you read, Vayigash Yehuda, often translated, and Judah stepped forward, with all the implications found in that. He stepped forward. Now, please remember that this is a moment where Joseph is supreme and has all the authority, as we're told, the power of the king of Egypt. But it also becomes, if you read the text carefully, the first stirring of the emergence of the house of Judah, who stepped forward as the future leaders of Israel. As we know, because we're familiar with these texts, a star, interesting, there's that image again, a star shall come forth from Jacob, and a scepter to rule from Israel. You know what a scepter is? The emblem of the royal authority. Oh, and remember that prophecy I just quoted to you comes from another strange prophet from the east by name of Balaam. From this same area, and in all likelihood, what he had predicted, he brought back with him, and others in that part of the world came to remember it as well. But we also know something that's going to take place in next week's parsha, that the scepter will not depart from Judah. And this is what Jacob says. So not just from Jacob, but particularly from Judah. But Vayigash Yehuda can also mean that Judah drew near. Not just that he stepped forward, but that he drew near. In other words, if you envision this scene, there's a joining, in effect, there's a uniting of two houses and of two images. And therefore, once again, it yields us with the picture of the reunification of Joseph, or Ephraim, and Judah. And therefore, you have the combining of two messianic aspects that the rabbis made note of. And the former has to do with Ephraim as the son of Joseph, and it reaches fruition at the time of the latter, the one who's called the son of David. Let me suggest that in this particular text, Vayigash means both. He stepped forward and he drew near. It's part of the layers that you find in this particular text. Now, Judah's most prominent descendant is David, and we find him in the Haftarah. And David's most important descendant is the Messiah. Therefore, the rabbis described the Messiah as Mashiach ben David, son of David, basing themselves on Genesis 49. But how does Joseph figure into all of this? Well, Joseph is a highly regarded individual, subsequently known in our traditions as Yosef HaTzadik. HaTzadik. This is a tradition that grew up among our people, that once in a lifetime would come someone who's especially a standout in his or her behavior before God, and our so-called HaTzadik, Yosef HaTzadik. And in fact, you'll notice some of that implied in our text as elongated. The story of Joseph occupies 14 chapters in Genesis. Therefore, our ancient rabbis correctly recognized Joseph as a very important pattern for the Messiah, and so they called a second Messiah, Messiah, son of Joseph, or Mashiach ben Yosef. And they refer to Mashiach ben Yosef, even in the Talmud, Sukkot 52, more precisely. They refer to Mashiach ben Yosef as a suffering and dying Messiah. Now, in light of all this, notice some intriguing phrases in our parasha. As he speaks, Judah says, "Be Adonai." Adonai, my Lord. That's pretty highly, how should we put it? Highly revered kind of terminology. He describes Joseph as that. And then he says, "Ki kamoka kefaro," you are like Pharaoh. Remember, in effect, he's saying, my Lord, you are like God. And then there's another interesting thing that comes a little later than where I stopped reading. Judah is now saying that Akiv mate, our brother, is dead. Joseph is dead. Well, to his surprise, later on in our parasha, he's been resurrected because Joseph says, I, your brother, am alive. And then a couple paragraphs after that, Jacob shows up on the scene and says, this is my son. You are alive. In effect, he's come back from the dead. Now, this parasha expresses the hope that the Haftarah pictures. And here, let me quote from a rabbi whom I found especially helpful, former chief rabbi of Efrat in Israel. Rabbi Shlomo Riskin comments on this text, and he says, we must wait for the Messiah of Joseph to join with the Messiah of Judah, David, for Jerusalem to become the spiritual capital of Israel, of Torah, and of the world. End quote. In other words, he's reflecting on one of the texts that we do as part of our service. The Shamru, Vayahi ben Soa. The word of the Lord will go out from Jerusalem, the text reminds us. We wait for the joining of the Messiahs. Or as we understand it, that joining is when the one who was Mashiach ben Yosef reappears now as Mashiach ben David. Now, quite likely, the Jewish Magi understood the significance of our parsha and our Haftarah portion for this evening. And they had undoubtedly been where He was from, remembered the stories told about Balaam or Balaam. Star will rise for Jacob. And as students of Daniel, they would have known Daniel's predictions, which tell us when the Messiah would show up on earth, Daniel chapter 9. And so they came to worship the king, and they brought him gifts, exactly like another interesting passage, which I'll get to in a couple minutes, pictured, Isaiah chapter 60. And so they bowed before him. They wanted to serve him, this child, which raises the question, do we worship him? Do we bow to serve him? We'll get a chance to do exactly that when we respond in just a few minutes with the Elenu. We need to be reminded, too, of his words as he was a rabbi and teacher as he grew and walked among us for 3.5 years. He said, if you love me, you'll follow my instructions. But, of course, we were familiar with that because as a people, we stood before God and said basically the same thing at Mount Sinai. All the Lord has said, we will do. Exodus 19. And let me suggest, if we don't follow through on this, God may just have to jolt us awake. But in all fairness, I need to concede something. We left that mysterious light just sort of dangling out there in the sky. What was it? Well, let me share some thoughts, and I do mean very briefly. Thomas Hyde, an eminent Orientalist, says that a pupil of Daniel the prophet predicted that when they should see a new star appear, it would be to notify. And a little later, it was stated that this new star was to appear, interestingly enough, in the sign of the constellation of the Virgin. And so they came, being astronomers, to Jerusalem, the capital of the Jewish king. Now, there's a beautiful tradition which relates how in their difficulty on their way to Jerusalem, in their difficulty to find the actual spot under the star that they were to go to, that these magi sat down beside David's well of Bethlehem to refresh themselves. And then they saw the star clearly reflected in the water of the well. And so it's written, when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding joy, for they knew that they were at the very spot from where he was to come forth. There is, however, an interesting observation about that star, and it brings us back full circle to the picture found in Isaiah chapter 60, of which a picture of these wise people bringing gifts. And so another explanation for the mystery of the Star of Bethlehem. The Greek word, translated star, means radiance. It's like the word used to describe the fire that described the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3, and even more relevant to us tonight, to describe the picture in Ezekiel chapter 11. And I'll read. The glory of the Lord went up. Did you catch that? The glory of the Lord went up from within the city and stopped above the mountain east of it. Sounds a little like our moving star, doesn't it? Hovering before leaving Jerusalem for a time. In fact, that is the last direct mention of the glory of the Lord found in the Old Testament, in the Tanakh. Now listen to what Luke wrote. An angel of the Lord appeared to the shepherds, and the glory of the Lord shone around them. Perhaps this was intended so we would understand that this demonstrated that the glory of the Lord had returned to Israel. Now as promised, Isaiah chapter 60. You'll recognize it. We sing it in Lechad Odi. Arise, shine, listen, for your light has come, listen again, and the glory of the Lord rises on you. See, darkness covers the earth, but the Lord rises on you, and his glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Lift up your eyes, look about you. Your children come from afar. Camels will cover your land, bearing gold and incense. Sound and look familiar? And proclaiming the praise of the Lord. Flocks of sheep will be gathered to you as well. Imagine that imagery. The Star of Bethlehem came with a message. With that Christmas star, God intruded into history and he changed everything. And let me suggest, this is God's great gift to us all. A gift that we far too often soon forget or ignore, or just plain don't fully appreciate. It's an important lesson for us to remember, especially at this time, because Monday truly brings to an end this significant season, since historically it celebrates the arrival of the ancient Jewish astronomers from the East, wise people who truly understood this lesson. The story of Scrooge in Christmas Carol is one of my favorite stories. You'll remember after his own nighttime experience, Scrooge finally learned what this season is really all about, why these Jewish magi came so hurriedly and excitedly. They came to celebrate, to worship, and to serve. Therefore, we too need to remember. Remember and celebrate, then worship and serve. Scrooge also realized that God's gift goes on, hence the title of the drash. So he vows to keep Christmas all year long. So should we, as we thank him for the gift that goes on and serve him gratefully and joyfully. Then we will be like the father at the end of this Christmas story that I'm about to share with you. We will be like the father at the end of the story when too often we're too much like the one at the beginning. This story goes that some time ago, a man punished his 3-year-old daughter for wasting a roll of gold wrapping paper. Because, you see, money was tight, and he became infuriated when the child tried to decorate a box to put under the Christmas tree. Nevertheless, the little girl brought the gift to her father the next morning and said, "This is for you, Daddy." And so he was duly embarrassed by his earlier overreaction. But his anger flared again when he found that the box was empty. He yelled at her, "Don't you know when you give someone a present, there's supposed to be something inside it?" The little girl just looked up at him with tears in her eyes and said, "Oh, Daddy, it's not empty. I blew kisses into the box, all for you, Daddy." The father was crushed. He wrapped his arms around his little girl and begged her for forgiveness. As the story concludes, we're told that the father kept that gold box by his bed for years. And whenever he was discouraged, he would take out an imaginary kiss and remember the love of the child who put it there. The gift goes on, and we need to take good advantage of it and say thank you and serve him. Take the next minute or so of time of reflection and quiet.